Hello and welcome to The Whole Health Cure, a space for trustworthy, science-based information on how you can live healthier and longer through the way you eat, move, think, and recover. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a physician, scientist, and lifestyle medicine pioneer with over 25 years of experience in patient-centered clinical care. Our conversation today is on how to avoid food additives and emulsifiers and their effect on our health. Dr. Don Harris-Sherling is a board-certified internal medicine physician who's also board-certified in obesity medicine. She began studying journalism before switching to pre-med studies at the University of Florida, where she graduated with honors and a Phi Beta Kappa. She earned her MD with honors from Yale University School of Medicine and then completed her residency at Harvard's Brigham and Women's Hospital, where she went on to serve as an attending physician and instructor in medicine at Harvard University. She moved back to her native Florida in 2008 and currently sees patients at a clinic for underserved populations and is an associate program director for the internal medicine residency at the Charles Schmidt College of Medicine at Florida Atlantic University. She is most recently the author of Eat Everything, How to Ditch Additives and Emulsifiers, Heal Your Body, and Reclaim the Joy of Food. Don, so great to have you.
Thank you. So much fun to be here.
Yeah, Don, you know, we've had so many episodes around the topic of food, but most of the conversations we've had have been around macronutrients and around micronutrients in food, but very little have we focused on emulsifiers and additives. How did you find your way into this topic?
I found my way into this topic, I think, by accident. I was a doctor and I sort of became the patient when I started struggling with irritable bowel syndrome myself. And it was something that I did the things that we tell patients to do all the time, which is maybe cut out dairy. So I did that. Maybe cut out gluten. So I did that. Try low FODMAP. So I did that. And, you know, nothing really worked great. I tried to convince myself that things were working and nothing worked great. And I remember my patients coming and telling me, when they were doing low FODMAP, "This is so hard. Do you have anything else?" And I was like, "Yeah, no, this is it. This is what you do now." Well, hopefully I wasn't quite that dismissive, but you know, it's something along those lines. And it really was just this part of my life. I had had two children. I was so busy. I was so stressed. I was like, okay, this is just something else I have to deal with. And then we decided to take a trip to Italy. And I was so nervous about that because I said, oh my gosh, I'm going to go to Italy and pizza and pasta and gelato and it's going to wreck me, right? We get to Italy and I'm very, very cautious at first in eating the food there because I was afraid of that food, right? We were not supposed to eat that stuff if we have irritable bowel. And I slowly but surely started to eat it. I mean, maybe within a day or two, right? Because who can resist? So started to eat that stuff. And nothing happened. I felt fine. And I was like, oh, okay. So I started getting a bit more adventurous. And within a few days, I realized I could literally eat everything in Italy. So hence the title of the book, right? Because I didn't care. I didn't think about it, right? Not only was I not thinking about dairy or gluten or FODMAPs, I wasn't thinking about macros or carbs, you know, sugar content. Like I was just enjoying the food, which is something I think the Italians are known for. So I kind of embraced that. And it was awesome. I get back to the US within 24 hours, my IBS comes roaring back and I'm miserable. And I'm like, oh, maybe I was eating more vegetables there. Maybe I was walking more. Maybe, you know, I was on vacation. I had less stress. When my patients would come back from vacation and tell me these things, I'd say, oh, it was just, you were less stressed when you were on vacation, right? And so I thought those things. Okay, well, whatever I tried to do back in the US didn't work. The next summer, we actually got to go back and spend a little bit of time in Italy again. And just right when I landed, everything was fine again. And I was like, okay, this is weird. Like, why is this happening? So I started paying attention to what I was eating there, looking at the packages. And I realized the packages were very, very different. And for the most part, we were eating fresh food, right? Even when you go to a restaurant there, I think when you go to a restaurant in the US, it's a lot of prepackaged stuff that the kitchen is just putting together. I catered a party recently and was talking to the chef, and it was actually my book launch party. And I was like, I don't want any emulsifiers or additives. And he was like, well, then you can't have ice cream. There's no way I can source that without that stuff. Well, I'll make this sauce from scratch that I usually just open a jar for because you don't want this stuff, right? So even restaurants and caterers are using pre-prepared foods. Now we're calling ultra-processed foods, which may be a term you're familiar with, maybe not. Maybe we can talk about that in a little bit. And I decided to cut those things out of my diet in the US when I got back. And it turns out that I felt great again. I felt like I was back in Italy. So I started advising my patients to do similar. And they also felt a lot better. Not only that, but my patients struggling with their blood sugars got a lot better. And we can talk about that too and why that may be. But it was just really transformative for me. So I was like, okay, I've got to write this book because I feel like this is so important. The data has been coming out actually since about 2017 in Fast and Furious, in really high impact factor journals. And we need to just start talking about it.
Yeah. And it's amazing when you experience it yourself and it does switch the role from doctor to patient and changes really the advice that you give. So let's go back to Italy and the food in the US. So the differences between the food, what were the big differences?
The differences in Italy is everything's really pretty fresh for the most part. Not to say they don't snack, but their intake of ultra-processed food compared with the US is way less. We have one of the highest intakes. We're eating almost 60% ultra-processed food here in the US, and our kids are maybe eating up to 70% on average ultra-processed food in a given day, which is a lot. Maybe in Italy, it's something closer to 20% or so for the average family. And for the most part, it's fresh food, freshly prepared food. They're really, you know, embrace their food culture. It's a big part of their culture. And if you go to a restaurant there, you might get three choices of vegetable. It's not infinite. It's like, this is what's growing there. This is what you get. You're not going to get a million choices. And food changes. The menus are changing. Things are changing. And so it's a different way of looking at food, really.
And Dawn, you've mentioned ultra-processed a couple times. So can you explain that term?
Sure. So I am borrowing from the NOVA food classification system, which I also talk about in my book, which was developed by a physician scientist in Brazil by the name of Carlos Montero, along with the team. So they looked at food and they were trying to think about, well, how can we start sorting processed from ultra-processed? Because we talk about processed food, but is there a difference? And it turns out that there is a difference. So the NOVA system says category one foods are whole foods. And that should form the basis of any diet. Any healthy diet should be mostly whole foods. Category two foods in the NOVA system are culinary ingredients. So these are things like spices, salt, oil, and they accompany food when you're preparing the food. So you shouldn't use a ton of oil, but you can use some oil to prepare your food, right? Some butter to prepare your food. Spices, salt, not too much salt, right? But in food preparation, go ahead, use some salt. Category three are the traditionally processed foods. So things like actual bread. So I did, during the pandemic, turn into one of those sourdough bakers. And I can tell you the ingredients in real sourdough bread, right? It's the sourdough starter, which is basically just your yeast and bacteria and things that are growing on your counter or in your fridge in a container, water, flour, and some salt. That's it. That's bread. So that's a processed product, but it's not ultra processed. Same thing with traditional cheeses, things like that. Processed, right? Milk is your whole ingredient. Cheese is your processed ingredient, but it should only be milk and the cheese cultures and maybe a little bit of salt in the cheese. And that should be it. So when we look at ultra processed, that's category four. Category three are the traditionally processed foods in NOVA. Category four in NOVA are the ultra processed foods. And those are things that are full of the additives and emulsifiers, and they're meant to stay shelf stable for long periods of time, but not using traditional for hundreds or even thousands of years processes like fermentation that you might do for yogurt, but putting a ton of stuff into the yogurt to make it thicker, to make it last longer. Those things then make the food ultra processed.
And in terms of the additives and the emulsifiers, so additives include food colorings, and what are the different types of additives?
There are a whole bunch of different types of additives, and the European classification system is probably the best one. And they break it down to all kinds of things like you're talking about, like humectants, anti-humectants, colorants, flavorings, stabilizers, right? So tons of different categories. And so when I wrote my book, I was really looking at the stuff because we have thousands of additives, right? And I think it's really hard to say avoid all additives. Some people can, and that's amazing. But I think it can be really, really challenging. And then, you know, of late, people are challenging the ultra-processed definition, saying, well, is this ultra-processed because it has some calcium carbonate in it? Is this ultra-processed because it has some citric acid in it, right? Or ascorbic acid, or something that we know to be pretty innocuous in food, and start arguing those details. So when I wrote my book, I was like, okay, where's the evidence for this? And actually, when I came back from Italy, so I said, I'm doing PubMed searches on these ingredients, right? What do we know about what's in the food? What do we really know? Because we used to think, at least when I was in medical school, that whatever we don't digest just passes through us innocuously, goes into the toilet, end of story. And now we know that's not exactly true because we're starting to sort through the mysteries of the microbiome. So nature abhors a vacuum. If we're not using an additive for energy, for calories, for something, our microbiome probably will. The fact of the matter is, nature is built to use all its resources. So our microbiome actually winds up using a lot of the additives. And it turns out that those additives that our microbiomes use tend to have more of an impact on our gut and probably outside of our gut as well, now that we have a lot of information about the stuff the microbiome is doing through the short-chain fatty acids that they produce when they utilize the substances that we're eating for energy. We're starting to recognize that those additives are probably the ones that we need to be paying a lot of attention to. And so that's what I try to focus on.
And Dawn, in the kind of bigger picture of, you know, there's so many variables in food that we need to take into account. Certainly, you know, when we think of microbiome, we think of fiber. We also want to make sure we get adequate protein, adequate vitamins, minerals. In terms of impact on health, the reason I think additives and emulsifiers haven't gotten the attention is, like you said, each person may think each one has a small impact and we're not really looking at it as an aggregate of an effect. But when we look at the aggregate of all, like throughout the day, like you said, every little thing probably has some additive. And over the course of the day, even if we're eating minimally processed food and not ultra processed, we're still, I'm sure, getting some additives. How is that on a relative scale, if we can think of it in relative terms, compared to, say, macronutrients? Like if we're eating hamburgers and fries, we know that's not good. But the impact on health of, even if we're eating what we presume are healthy foods, but there's some minimally processed and we're getting these additives and preservatives, what kind of impact is that having? Is it significant? Is it something? How worried should we be?
That's a great question that a group of researchers from Brazil actually tried to answer. And this study, I want to say it came out about a year ago. And what they looked at, and so again, minimally processed is NOVA category 3, right? And shouldn't have those additives in it. When you start adding those additives like emulsifiers, food gums, maltodextrins, carrageenans, those are the things that make stuff ultra processed. And it's in a lot of our food. And when you start looking at those foods, which is what this group of researchers did, they basically looked at each 10% increment. So if you ate 10% ultra processed food, 20%, 30%, 40%, looking at nutrition surveys and then following a pretty big population out, I think this was tens of thousands of people or maybe even over 100,000 people that they followed out for a number of years, and look at your chances of mortality. It tracked for every 10% increment more ultra-processed food that you ate, your chances of mortality within whatever time frame the study was went up. So there seemed to be a pretty big correlation. And of course, they tried to correct for things like social determinants of health and other things that might be associated with eating a more highly processed diet. So they did try to factor in for those other things, and it did seem, it was a fairly well-done study, and it did seem that the more ultra-processed food you ate, the higher your chances of having diet-related disease and of succumbing to diet-related disease.
That's interesting. You also mentioned emulsifiers. How does that factor in with some of these additives?
Sure. So emulsifiers are a certain kind of additive. And what an emulsifier is basically a way to get oil and water to mix. So we know oil and water don't like to mix. And if you use an emulsifier, you get those things to mix and you make it really shelf stable, right? It's why when I bought natural peanut butter, and if you buy natural peanut butter, it'll separate, right? You'll get a layer of oil and then the peanut butter, and it doesn't look very attractive. And if you buy peanut butter with emulsifiers in it, it'll stay nicely mixed for potentially years. So it looks much nicer and it's more shelf stable. So it's very popular with food makers, the food industry. And emulsifiers tend to, in studies that are done, there was a study that was done, I want to say 2015, 16, 17, somewhere around there, out of France. And what they looked at were all kinds of different emulsifiers. And this was not in humans, but this was using human stool, poop. And they basically looked at the different emulsifiers' effect on the microbiome and how those different emulsifiers, right? Because like I was alluding to earlier, the microbiome is going to use the emulsifiers as fuel. So some bacteria are going to preferentially grow depending on what you feed it. And you mentioned fiber earlier, and we talk about probiotics and that fibers, right? We don't digest fibers. Our gut bacteria do. And if we're feeding the gut bacteria good, healthy fiber within the food matrix, right? So within an apple, within oatmeal, within really whole foods or minimally processed foods, it seems to promote a healthier microbiome than many of these emulsifiers, if they're present, and really not in super big concentrations, tend to shift the microbiome to a less healthy microbiome. So that's something that is really concerning. And there have been some studies done, smaller studies, of course, because it's hard to do these studies in people, showing that depending on what you're eating, additive-wise, that can shift your microbiome. And if you're eating a healthier diet, more whole foods-based diet, it's less inflammatory, right? There was one study, I think, out of Stanford where they measured inflammatory markers in people that were eating a higher fiber diet, natural fibers contained in whole food, or more fermented food diet. And it turns out that the folks on the fermented food diet actually had lower inflammatory markers, which is really interesting, and just having to do with the shifts that eating those fermented foods caused within the microbiome.
And is that the connection between additives and emulsifiers? Is it via gut microbiome that it's impacting health? Are there other ways that it's impacting our inflammatory status or other ways it's getting into our body?
Probably. We know that that changes our biome, but we also know that when you have a highly processed food, and especially now everyone's wearing those continuous glucose monitors, right? And what's interesting is I take care of a patient population that unfortunately can't afford that stuff, but they are very young, a lot of them coming from Central America, with diabetes in their 30s and 40s. And up until caring for this population, I was like, well, we all just need to move more, right? That's the message we've gotten. And it's a good message, but my patients do move more. They're construction workers and landscapers and house cleaners. They don't stop moving. So why on earth do they have diabetes in their 30s and 40s? It's counterintuitive. And it turns out, and really out of control diabetes, right? So we're talking about sugars in the 300 and 400s. We're talking about hemoglobin A1C, so the measure of your blood sugar over 3 months when they come in to the clinic of 13 or 14, super high, right? So normal being less than 5.7. And I say to them, okay, I used to say to folks with diabetes, well, you know, cut down on your carbs, which is good advice, right? It's not bad advice. If you have diabetes, you have trouble processing carbs, cut down on your carbs. But the real big difference came when I would ask patients to eat less ultra-processed food. And a lot of my patients come from countries with strong food cultures. So if I'm talking to a patient that comes from a country with a less strong whole foods-based culture, they didn't grow up with whole foods, it's really hard to explain how to eat a whole foods-based diet. If I'm talking to someone who grew up with eating whole foods and I say, eat more whole foods, eat more natural foods, a lot of them just get it immediately. And it's totally different because that's how they grew up. And so they're able to do that and make that shift and cut their hemoglobin A1C numbers from 13 down to 7 with minimal medication. And some of them are able to go off the medication when they cut out the ultra-processed stuff. So there's something about the ultra-processed food. Is it just the additives? No, it's probably right. This high sugar content, no one's saying that's good. These really processed carbohydrates, right, that have the fiber stripped from it. And then even if they try to add it back, you know, and you look and the food gums are considered fibers, but they're being digested, right? Because it's sort of like this food is pre-digested. And so in the ultra-processed food, those fibers, the added fibers, are being digested way earlier in our GI tract than they would be if they were within a food matrix, in an apple, in a vegetable, in something that your body needed to digest. The actual fibers wouldn't get to where they're going until later, wouldn't get be able to be digested by the microbiome until later. So there are all kinds of things at play with ultra-processed food that aren't good.
Absolutely. I mean, it changes the macronutrients, the micronutrients, like you said. So it's the whole package of it has so many ways that it impacts health. So if a person wants to avoid ultra-processed foods, I mean, like you said, you can certainly start with whole foods, but you know, people eat meals and meals are made more of more than just single ingredients. How would you advise a person to make a transition and what should their grocery store trip look like, et cetera?
Yeah, so it's hard. Change is hard, right? And it's hard for us to change all at once. Nobody can decide, okay, I'm going to go to the grocery store tomorrow and not buy any ultra-processed food and just make everything from scratch if you've never done that before. That becomes a challenge. And so what I tell people to do is just pick one or two items that you're going to examine, that you're going to look at, right? So if you generally buy yogurt, look at your yogurt. If it has 7, 8, 9, 10 ingredients, and those aren't, you know, the bacteria that are in there, the yogurt cultures, but you know, you're looking at food gums and you're looking at maltodextrin or high fructose corn syrup or all of these things, decide to go and look for another brand of yogurt that's just milk and yogurt cultures. And don't buy flavored yogurt, but decide, okay, I'm going to put some fruit into my yogurt. Maybe a drizzle of honey if you want it to be a little bit sweeter, right? Some nuts in there for a little extra fiber and protein, right? And those macros that we're talking about to make it more satisfying as well. But buy plain yogurt, plain Greek yogurt, and say, okay, I'm going to look at the bread that I'm buying. And if it has a zillion ingredients, I'm going to go to the freezer aisle because real bread actually needs to stay frozen. If you've ever had real bread, it's going to last a day or 2 days. If it's sourdough, maybe you can get 5 days on the counter where it's okay. So if your bread's lasting a few weeks, it's not bread. It's ultra-processed bread-like substance. So go to the freezer section, see what breads are there, and see if you can get some minimally processed bread out of the freezer section or even the bakery section. But I will caution that in the supermarket, a lot of the things that are meant to look freshly baked are not really. So there's been a lot of effort put into kind of not being super honest with consumers. So I tell people, ignore the front of the package and look at the back of the package and look at the ingredients and really see, do I have these ingredients? Would I have these ingredients in my kitchen? And if you're looking at stuff and it's like, no, I don't have xanthan gum in my kitchen, although some people do now. And they sell it at specialty grocery stores in the health food aisle, which is frightening, right? Because it's been associated with inflammatory bowel disease, colitis, other things. And so the fact that, you know, it's mind-boggling, right? So if it wasn't in your mother's kitchen or your grandmother's kitchen or your father's kitchen or your grandfather's kitchen, maybe leave it and look for something else. But one or two items, when you go to the grocery store, make that switch. And if you're not a cook, try learning to make some simple meals. Don't try to make something super complicated. when my son, we said, okay, you're going to start to learn how to cook. It's very important, right? He's going off to college next year. You've got to learn to start to cook. And he picked this super intricate dish to make. And no, it didn't go well. So no, pick something simple. I'm just going to make something simple and easy and with using whole ingredients and one dish. Start from that.
Dawn, are there like a top five additives to avoid? Like, is there, I mean, there are just so many. And I think when people look at that ingredient label, there's probably different gradations of harm, if you will. And some, like you said, you know, as a rule of thumb, you know, it's if you can't pronounce it right, it's probably not good for you. But in that bucket are also, like you mentioned, yogurt cultures, which are good for you, and you can't pronounce any of those. So it can get a little confusing of all those things that you wouldn't have in your kitchen, which are super bad. What should be on your absolutely do not eat list? Or is that a framework that we can look at it? Are there like different gradations, or is it just a general rule of thumb of the less the better?
I mean, the less the better. I think that's a good rule of thumb, but for sure, right? So we have some researchers, dedicated researchers who are working on trying to sort out, are all additives terrible for us? Probably not. But the issue is that they've gotten approved, they've gotten into our food system with very little research, right? And if they even have any research on them, which most of them don't really, it's very limited feeding studies. I think only a quarter of food additives have had feeding studies, and then it's generally in a healthy population for a couple of weeks. We're consuming these things for years and years and years. So, you know, the problem is we don't know what we don't know. But here's what we do know. We do know that there are certain additives that have been studied that really seem to be bad actors. So I mentioned carrageenan. Carrageenan is one that is pro-inflammatory. And in my book, I tell an anecdote about my husband working in the lab, working in research with mice, where he used carrageenan to cause inflammation in the mice. So then he could then treat the inflammation with whatever they were testing. You know, and he feels very badly about having done that. But he did do that. And when we were looking at our cream cheese and there was carrageenan in it, my husband was like, what? What's in that? And I was like, look, here, it says carrageenan. And he was like, I use that in the lab to cause inflammation. Well, it turns out carrageenan, yes, causes inflammation in humans too, and we should probably not be eating it. So if you see carrageenan, don't eat it. Maltodextrin is another one that is not an emulsifier. It's actually more like a sugar molecule. But maltodextrin has been associated with fatty liver disease, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which now everybody seems to have. When I was in training, that was, you know, almost in no one who didn't have an alcohol use disorder. So now we're seeing fatty liver in everybody. And maltodextrin has been implicated in that, as well as metabolic syndrome, as well as lots of other things. So maltodextrin, good to avoid. Polysorbate 80 is another one that's been studied, and that's been shown to be pro-inflammatory, associated with inflammatory bowel disease. The same thing with CMC, carboxymethyl cellulose, has been shown, just like polysorbate in those studies, to be associated with a whole slew of diseases, but really a lot of colitis is the most worrisome thing. Okay, so you asked me for five. So my fifth one is, I'm going to cheat, and I'm going to say anything gum. So if there is some word followed by the word gum, drop it, because it is not probably good. A lot of the different gums have been studied and are associated with some ill effects. I mentioned xanthan gum, and there are a lot of other gums that have been associated with ill effects. So if you see those, any of those five, I would leave it alone. And I think if you're doing that, that's plenty. I list 25 additives in my book, but those five, I would say, if I had to pick the biggest offenders to avoid, if I could only avoid five, those would be the five.
Where do artificial sweeteners fit in this picture?
So I have artificial sweeteners in my book listed in the to avoid list. And now, given the evidence that's come out in the last year or so, I kind of want to throw all the artificial sweeteners in there, right? Like, let's just avoid them completely, because the WHO came out, the World Health Organization came out, I'm sure you saw a few months ago, saying, yeah, there's no evidence that artificial sweeteners help prevent disease and, in fact, may be contributing to it. And people like went nuts when this. They were like, what? This is crazy. And they were like clutching their Diet Coke to their chest. And they were like, don't take this away from me. Okay, nobody's coming for your Diet Coke. It's okay. But I think what the WHO was saying was, listen, these things are not super well studied, actually. They're being promoted as healthy. And there's not data to support that claim. So if you love your Diet Coke, have your Diet Coke, it's okay, or your diet, whatever. It's not really diet because, as the WHO pointed out, they're not really associated with weight loss or maintenance of weight loss. And what people, I think, forget is in that WHO statement, that World Health Organization statement, they also said, like, chill out with the sugar too, although they probably worded it a little bit better than that. So it's not like they want you to consume a ton of sugar. People are like, well, if I give this up, then I'm going to have to drink a real Coke. I don't think it works that way. No, the WHO is saying, drink water. If you're going to have a real Coke, I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's just as bad. Maybe it's worse. Maybe it's not worse. We actually don't know. But probably don't have Coke. Don't have a Diet Coke, at least not regularly. Occasionally, fine. We can do anything occasionally, right, for the most part. But for the most part, pick water. Pick something that is not an ultra-processed substance to drink.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask you my last question. And, you know, when you were in Italy, you obviously had to eat in restaurants and, you know, get food on the go. And a lot of people that, you know, live here end up eating out a lot of meals and don't home prepare. And of course, if you're in Italy, you're lucky because you get to eat fresh seasonal vegetables. And here, like you said, even if you think you're ordering healthy, probably the way the food is sourced may already be ultra processed. What's your advice for people that are going to just grab and go? They don't have time to get ingredients from scratch and avoid the ultra processed from the grocery store. So what's a good way to navigate the eating out part?
Great question. So in the book, Eat Everything, I have a whole chapter devoted to eating out because I want to be able to offer people actionable advice. It's not useful just to say, oh my gosh, everything's terrible and there's nothing we can do. And, you know, let's all put on our tinfoil hats and go in our bunkers. No, that is not good advice. I wrote this book because also patients asked me, tell me what I can eat. Just tell me what I can eat. Some of those patients on the low FODMAP diet, just tell me, just stop telling me what I can't eat, right? So when you're going out to eat, I think the best piece of advice is just try to recognize the food. If you can recognize the food, right? If you're going somewhere and you see a chicken and it looks like chicken as opposed to a chicken nugget, and you can identify the substance and say, oh yes, that looks like chicken, that's probably better than the alternative. And not that it's coated in a ton of breading or anything like that. If you were talking about a burger and fries, so instead of fries, a baked potato, right? It looks like a potato. And you're like, oh yes, I can identify that. You know, it looks like how it looked when it came. So whatever we're doing, wherever we are, whether we're at home, whether we're out, if you can eat things that look more like how they originally came from nature, you're probably doing a pretty good job. So I would say when you go out to eat, just look at the stuff. And if you can order a salad with oil and lemon on the side, because dressings are a big culprit where they put a lot of these thickeners and emulsifiers. Lemon looks like lemon, you know, oil. Yes, it's processed, but minimally, hopefully. Put that on your salad instead of the dressing. And you can identify all the ingredients. You're on your way.
Mm-hmm. Dawn, is there anything that you think is important for people to know that we haven't had a chance to talk about?
I think the really important thing is we're all so stressed out about food. We're stressed out about everything. And I don't want to give people another thing to be stressed out over, right? Because I'm sure you've talked in your podcast before about how stress is not good for us, right?
And that'll flare your IBS.
Yeah, it'll flare your everything, right? Stress is bad. Stress is bad for our health. Don't stress. Let's just try to learn something from cultures that are able to find joy in food and embrace food. We're so worried about our food all the time. And that's not good either. So I would say, try to find the things that make you happy, that bring you joy when you eat. If those are good for you too, even better. But as much as you can, try to just find the joy again in eating, because it's just become another thing to worry about. And that's not great either. So we want to be joyful
We want to have fun with it. And if you can, you know, with friends, doing things with friends is always better. Getting your family involved with you to try to cook, or at least make them clean up, right? If you're going to cook, which is what we try to do here, not always successfully. But yeah, just again, try to enjoy it. Try to make it something you can enjoy.
That's great. Well, Dawn, thank you so much. This is great information. It's just good to think about, you know, what we're eating and all the different things that impact our health that we don't stop and really pay attention to. So thank you for the information, and thank you for all the work you do taking care of patients and being on the front line.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.